market propaganda and corrupt politics. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Dr. Nicholas Behem III. On today's program, we will discuss critical studies regarding surveillance and authoritarianism. Our guest is Kalemba Kizito. Please stay with us. Turn the global economy, we're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring, an anomaly to those who can't imagine a world
without oppressive forces slaving for almighty dollar bills. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host Desiree McSwain and Dr. Nicholas Behem III. We are broadcasting again from lovely Hayward, California, on the California State University East Bay campus. Feeling good today for another exciting show. Amy, why don't you tell us what's in store for us on the show today?
I am Amy Casey with the Media Freedom Foundation. Today, the Project Censored Show will examine critical studies regarding surveillance and authoritarianism. Our guest is Kalemba Kizito, a third-year doctoral student at the University of Memphis. His research interests are in critical media and cultural studies with a primary focus on exploring the role of emergent technologies as a cultural force. But first, a few reminders for our listeners. At this time, I would like to remind you of our projectcensored.org/podcast website. There you can check out past shows. For any feedback, questions, comments, concerns, please send us an email at projectcensoredradio@gmail.com. Now you can also catch us on Twitter. Both Nolan and Nick have Twitter accounts now. You can find Nolan at Nolan_Higdon, and you can find Nick at Dr. Dreadlocks. That is DocTorDreadlocks.
Cool. Thank you, Amy. And keeping with our Twitter conversation from last week, keep sending me your names for Desiree. Next show, we will unveil Desiree's chosen name from the listeners.
Da 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 da.
Desiree's very excited. Also online, Nick has his videos posted, so take a look at our social media pages and try and watch the films that are available there. And we're going to do a show on movies and authoritarianism based off Nick's list, and we're doing that just for you, the listeners. In fact, speaking of social media, we received more calls again, this time about a guest we had about, a month or two ago, which was Dr. Catherine Olmsted from UC Davis. We received calls about how when she was on the show, we didn't make it clear that 9/11 was an inside job done by the government. I'll, repeat something I've done at public events for 10 years, and it'll probably be ignored as it has been for the last decade. Project Censored is not a monolithic organization. Different people in the project have different views on different events, and that's a good thing. We believe in a diverse point of views. We believe in debate, critical debate, academic discussion. We had Dr. Olmsted on the show to talk about her work, which was about conspiracy theories and conspiracy culture. She was not on the show to talk about September 11th and the events of September 11, 2001. Thank you for ignoring me. More importantly, instead of calling us, leaving us messages, a much better way to get a hold of me, and if you actually want to engage with us here on the show, is contact us on Twitter or via email. We love having those discussions. We love bringing listener mail in. It's kind of tough in the phone calls. I can't really transcribe the message and bring it on the air. But if you do send an email or contact us with a direct message on Twitter, I'm happy to read it and discuss it on the air as we have done numerous times on the show. There's so much news going on that I wanted to focus on this week. I thought one of the things we should probably start with that we were kind of talking about prior to the show, which was these transgender tweets from Donald Trump. And Trump just sort of has this brain fart that he's going to ban transgender people from being in the military, but he didn't actually talk to his generals. His generals came out shortly thereafter and said, no, there's no policy in place to do this. So I think it shows kind of this, before we get into the discrimination tactics here and why they have a massive impact, I think it also reveals that he does not know how to operate a government. He thinks he's a king and you can just say something and it becomes law. And this goes back to something on the campaign trail. He posited himself as this businessman and this corporate leader. He's actually never been in charge of a private corporation that had shareholders. So he never had anyone to answer to. He's always ran a family business. Now, his family was rich, and he was famously born on third base and thought he had a triple. But when he has this power in a family business, you can fire people and decree things. You can't do that in government. So just to get that sort of out of the way about the tweet's actual impact on policy, I thought was important. But I don't know. I mean, at this point, Nick, Desiree, are you guys shocked anymore, or are you eye rolling at these events?
Well, the narcissism is bottomless. When you wake up in the morning and you say we've sunk to new depths, there are more to go. We're over 6 months in. There's more. There will be, barring impeachment, there will be 4 years of narcissistic depths to sink.
Yeah, I agree. And I think following anything that Trump does or says is like watching an OxyClean commercial where it's like, but wait, there's more. And it's just more bigotry and more racism. And I think with the trans situation, it's almost like he has a billboard and crosses out people of the month that he's going to attack. So it's going to be immigrants this month, and it's going to be trans, as if there are no trans immigrants, or if there are no black immigrants, and then you separate them. And I don't know if that's his divide tactic, but I think it is eye-rollable and it is laughable. And it's like Nolan said, it's funny to see how he views himself in his presidency, because I think it's the same as how most standard Americans view a president, as being all-powerful and the all-being, almost like Oz, where it's, no, he doesn't have the power to do a lot of the things that he talks about doing and that we believe he can do. I think the problem is when he gets people on board with him, or when he starts these campaigns that for whatever reason can kind of benefit maybe some people in Congress or some people, some Democrats or Republicans, that's when it really becomes a problem. But if it's just this narcissistic Gemini, and I'm a Gemini, so I know very well, him just sitting up there with his two personalities spewing all this, what's next? What's new?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, tweets are not policy. I think we all know that. Even if you didn't take civics, you know that tweets are not policy.
Okay. You should.
You should. If you don't know that, read up on that quickly.
This is an eye-opening experience.
Right. Second of all, there are 15,000 transgender American citizens who are in the military, in the volunteer military, by the way, who are put themselves on the line and are willing to die for this country no matter what the agenda is, no matter what the corporate agenda is. There's only, and frankly, the U.S. military is the largest employer of transgender people in this country. Second of all, there's only $8 million that's actually allocated to transgender persons serving in the military for elective surgery and medical benefits that are specific to transgender people. So what Trump specifically did here was he bastardized a Republican desire to remove those health benefits and developed that into a full-on ban of transgender people in the military. Now, look, as you know, I've said many times on this program, and to paraphrase the journalist Chris Hedges, Trump is an idiot. He's just a flat idiot. We are now in a position, though, where I think that corporate power, the power of American oligarchs, and state military power joined with that, which, by the way, is the formula for fascism, are so powerful that it doesn't matter if the idiocy is out in the streets. They can get away with it now. This is like the final stages of Rome. You can be a moron playing the violin while the country burns. It's in the open.
Yeah, I think on that point, and I think this goes back to what Desiree said. You notice Desiree said the word tactic, and I thought that was just so on point, that his numbers are failing, his policy is failing in Congress, he's the lowest rated president ever at this point. And then I think you pull out the old conservative or right-wing talking points, like, okay, let's go after transgender people in the military. You guys cared about that recently. And then he goes, gives the speech in front of police, right? Okay, so let's go back to police abusing people they arrest. All these things are tactics, right? It's saying, here, get with me. Here's our policy. Here's our program. Distraction, right? Because his comments about police, absolutely disgusting, and they fill the news and they create fodder. But again, it's distracting the fact he's not doing his job. There's no actual policy
there's
behind
nothing.
It.
There's no job being done. But if you look at the first 6 months here, let's go after women. Let's go after the news media. Let's go after women in the news media. Let's go after transgender folk. let's ignore the invitations of blacks, even conservative, relatively conservative organizations like the NAACP. Frankly, if you're a black radical activist, NAACP is relatively mainstream. So let's ignore them as well. I mentioned immigrants. Let's go after gangs. Okay. Let's go after Chicago, because Chicago has gangs, and on and on and on and on and on. But it is a circus. It is a distraction. It is like being in the Colosseum watching gladiator fights. So this week it is Trump the gladiator versus the transgender. And we're all distracted by this show. Ooh, who's going to win? Is the transgender going to win, or is Trump going to win? Well, but that's not really the issue. The issue is, again, we've got, as American citizens and as responsible people in the media, we've got to follow the money.
Yeah. Also, to add to that, and kind of what I was saying earlier about the danger being in when people jump on the bandwagon and just hear what they want to hear first and roll with that, I think just days later, just a couple days ago, there was another radio show, The Breakfast Club, which is really popular, especially in urban communities. But there was a comment being made about if a certain individual found out that he was dating a transgender, he would kill him. And people just kind of chuckled and laughed. Do you know how many transgender people are killed? It's ridiculous to even joke about that. And it's seemingly not a joke, because there's always some kind of truth to it. And when you're being backed by a president who has the same kind of sentiments, or it almost does, that's what I think is really dangerous. And people who have platforms like Spencer or some other people know about all these issues, that's when it kind of picks up and it becomes scary, because people become on the accord, or maybe they want to be on the same accord as a president or want to be. So that's, I think, what's really dangerous. And in the same week, if we're hearing the same thing, you can only imagine what can come from that.
It is dangerous. I teach a course on sexuality, African-American sexuality, here at East Bay. And we talk about this quite a bit. And I've been teaching this class since 2000. We don't get as many of these comments anymore, fortunately, because people are evolving. But I used to get those comments that when I would expose students who were heterosexist or deeply steeped in heteronormativity, and we would talk about transgender identity, they would say, well, the thing I got out, particularly men, okay, and we're talking about this fragile black masculinity, they would often say to me, hey, what I got out of this section is the next time I go out with somebody, I'm going to reach down there and try to figure out what's going on before I start getting involved. So you either get that sort of violent, fragile black masculine approach, or you get the opposite, which is, in private, sometimes students will tell you about how they fetishize, especially male-to-female transgender citizens. Neither of which are ways in which we need to ethically and responsibly and lovingly deal with our fellow transgender citizens in this country.
On this idea of using this as tactics, the language, and I think Desiree was on point too by saying that you connect this to actual actions that happen. Other leaders have been doing this as well. Like Duterte has done this as well with his war on drugs. Duterte is the president of the Philippines. He's done this with his war on drugs and his threats to bomb indigenous schools. And we hear this rhetoric here in the States, right? And we think, God, those people are so nuts over there, right? That leadership. Mm-hmm. But we have to remember, to Desiree's point, that's what's happening here, right? People are seeing this from Trump and hearing this around the world. And it does end up inspiring individuals to do violence. We've seen this for years, right? The old excuse, I just said it. I didn't know anybody was actually going to go out and do it. But I also think that we've talked about before, they're tapping into a lot of legitimate anger. And I want to sort of shift focus into another topic where sometimes I think leftists give some red meat to this conservative anger that makes it tough for progressives to kind of combat. There's been this discussion of how there's this war on free speech coming from the left, right? And they point to UC Berkeley blocking Milo and Ann Coulter from giving speeches. And my position on that remains, there's a big difference. You know, those are not academics. That's sort of like it's a public institution giving them a platform. And you're not really curtailing free speech, because only the government can do that, not student protesters. But you're in the Bay Area. There's a big difference. The KPFA news stations blocked a public event with Richard Dawkins. And people who don't know, Richard Dawkins is a scholar of religious studies and civilization. And they censored his speech, presumably about some of the comments he had made about the Islamic faith. And I draw a distinction here between blocking Dawkins as opposed to Coulter or Milo. Dawkins is an academic grounded in literature and has a conclusion based on evidence. That doesn't mean you have to agree with it. But at least for this idea, for people who believe in sort of having discussions, Dawkins clearly someone who's bringing evidence to the table to discuss. And I think that this conservative anger points to these type of actions to justify why they say they believe the left is actually attacking them instead of Duarte and the transgender comments and Trump's police comments. So I kind of wonder what you thought about this decision by KPFA to censor Dawkins, or if you can consider it censorship.
Yeah, it's especially when you want to make the contrast between the two, Dawkins with Yiannopoulos. Milo is specifically engaged in hate speech. And why do I say that? Because part of the protests that happened at Berkeley surrounded the fact that Milo had the intention of outing and naming specific people during his discussion. I think people have lost the concept of what free speech is. You say what you want to say, but you cannot specifically incite violence towards other individuals. The boundary line for all of your rights within a representative democracy ends when the exercise of your rights and your freedoms impinges on the rights and freedoms of other individuals in the society. So this is where the line is for me. It's not just the line between what is intellectual and what is pablum, because there is also that distinction between Yiannopoulos and Dawkins. And I think that that's relevant, especially if you're an intellectual and you're trying to deal with something at any level of depth. I take issue with censoring folk who are not engaged in hate speech, but who are engaged in presenting an argument. I don't have to agree with your argument, but if it's an argument and we're not targeting individuals, people are not leaving the auditorium with names or with some idea about being violent to others and destroying their rights, then I have no problem with what you with your argument, with your speech.
I think that this is such a relevant argument, and I can only think about going back to Facebook and platforms like that, where I myself, family members, and a lot of other people I know are being flagged, being deleted complete on simple posts like in Malcolm X quote. And then you have the total opposite, where I have a hate speech racist slur commented on one of my pictures, and it's been, and I didn't even check it for months, but it's been up there forever. And it's just laughable, because I think that it kind of is up to who is in control of the concept of free speech, because I think a lot of people's idea on hate speech being free speech comes from what we see from the presidency and from all these people who are quote unquote in charge, who get away with spewing hate speech and covering it up as free speech, but then we don't even really have the opportunity to assemble freely and to speak freely on our own land on topics that directly affect us and that are real fact-based topics like oppression and poverty, where we can fight and back it up. And if we have ideas against the system or against the European society standard, that's hate speech to many people, to the majority of the population. But then vice versa, you can say you hate Islam and hate all the people of that faith, and that's just free speech. And it's not fair, but how can you, should it be fair? Is there anybody that can even, I don't know, deem what's fair and what's not, and who's to say who's going to be in charge? There's no tracking system or anything to really deal with that. It's just people slip under the radar and reconstitute how we see free speech, and that's where we are now today.
Yeah, I mean, the only other way that you can deal with that is in the courts through slander and libel laws, and not everyone has access to be able to do that. But I think you bring up a very powerful point. Speaking truth to power is really at the core of freedom of speech in the country. It's not about my right to talk about whether I liked Wonder Woman as opposed to Spider-Man or some inane other social comment about something that doesn't matter. It's about my ability to speak truth to power. And that's really where I think as American citizens we're being progressively shut down. And I think that that's certainly happened since the 1960s. You know, do I have a right to really critique the capitalist order in the public sphere? And as a professor, do I or do I not have the right to speak to power, truth to power, in front of my students without being accused of brainwashing my students, when in fact all I'm trying to do is provide them with the tools of critique, which they can do whatever with that they want to do, okay? But do I have the right to do that as a professor? Do we have the right to, certainly the news media to a degree has, I think, really abdicated that right. And what's funny to me about the news media is that they pretend to speak truth to power, but they're not really substantive. They're not really hitting it where it really is. They're not really showing you where the money is and where the power is.
Well, so I want to pick up on that classroom theme, and I think it applies to media as well, that we celebrate, and for some reasons rightfully so, that we're able to kind of cater our lives to and what we consume to the way we want it, right? We can watch shows when we want. We can watch what we want when we want. We can get it wherever we want and whatever device we want. So we have this ability to customize on so many levels. Part of that, though, I think customization behavior has been we've customized out either inconvenient truths or just things we don't like to hear. And I think you saw this with Dawkins at KPFA. And I think there's a frustration in the classroom that some students have to listen to things they don't want to hear. But that kind of undermines the point, and on news media as well, but that undermines the point, I think, of news media and traditional classroom education, which is you're supposed to hear things you don't want to hear and then draw your own conclusions. The only real atrocity, I think, is if a teacher judges you on whether or not they adopt their opinion. If your grade depends on that, I think that's the only atrocity. But as far as sharing opinions in the classroom, that's what that space is for. It's mm-hmm. one of the best space on earth, and in news media as well. But given, I think, this customization we've seen become more and more accessible, people have used that as a way to block out things they don't like. And I think the conservatives especially have been able, as you both pointed out earlier, have been able to conflate hate speech with free speech, right? So that mm-hmm. when you combat hate speech, which is illegal, as you point out, then you're somehow stepping on someone's free speech. And without the knowledge of sort of experiencing different voices and a diversity of voices, I think individuals aren't able to tell the difference anymore.
Yeah, and I think we've moved away from Socratic and Platonic pedagogical principles. In a country that claims that it is at war, that the West, Western civilization is, whatever that is under threat, right? Ironically, we have sort of disavowed core Western principles, Greek principles, for example, which, by the way, and I don't really want to get into this right now, aren't purely Western European, but it developed in the Mediterranean, which was a very heterogeneous environment, North African, but, you know, we could go on, okay? These are really world principles that are shared, have been shared globally. But this notion that education comes from discursive encounter, right, from argumentation, from buttressing one idea up against the other, and from making arguments that are based on fact and some facts that we can agree upon, facts that are as cold and as objective as what the temperature is right now, right? We've moved away from this. It's conjecture. It's not fact-based. People who are in our news media who spout opinions often spout opinions that have absolutely no grounding to facts. They're ahistorical. And I think as a country, we're entering into some really critical times here where we need important debate. For example, North Korea. We're having a debate about North Korea being able to launch intercontinental ballistic missiles in 2018, but it is an ahistorical discussion. We are not, and it is a discussion that is devoid of fact, in the sense that we're not talking about the Korean War, or the atrocities that we committed in North Korea, that North Koreans have a memory of. We're not talking about military exercises that are ongoing in that region by the United States. What we are talking about is the fact that Kim Jong-un is a nut. Now, two things may be equally true. Kim Jong-un may be a nut. I do not know him personally, as Dennis Rodman knows him personally. But
that's where I get all my news
from Dennis Rodman, yes. And his tweets. And by the way, I'm not actually sure that Dennis Rodman is on Twitter, but I am going to check after this broadcast.
See, Desiree, everyone's on Twitter.
Yeah, if Rodman's on Twitter, then yeah.
Yeah, if he is, I'll try to confirm that with you. But I mean, there's a lot going on here, and we're not having a substantive fact-based dialogue about this. And policy is going to be created around a non-fact-based, non-fact-grounded discussion in the nuclear age.
Well, he does it to us every week. We talk about one tweet, and we cover our entire roundtable. All right, we'll be back with our guest, Kalimba Kizito, after this short musical break. Welcome. Back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host Desiree McSwain and Nicholas Baham III.
We're here with Kalimba Kizito, who is a third-year doctoral student at the University of Memphis. He was born and raised in Uganda, where he earned his Bachelor of Laws at Makerere.
That's correct.
Makerere University, before moving on to the United States. He later earned his Master of Arts degree in communication at Cal State East Bay, where he briefly taught as a part-time lecturer, as well as at Ohlone College, before moving to Memphis to pursue doctoral studies. His research interests are in critical media and cultural studies, with a primary focus on exploring the role of emergent technologies as a cultural force, interrogating their evolution and transformation as technologies of statecraft. Currently, he is looking at how surveillance and its extensive apparatuses function to politicize, propagate, and maintain difference in society. Through his research, he aims to draw connections to the historical dimensions of constructing difference and the role different technologies have and continue to play in that regard. So welcome, Kalimba. Welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you, and thank you for having me here.
We want to really talk to you within the context of sort of an ongoing series that we've had about emerging global expressions of global authoritarianism. So authoritarianism, generally speaking, the surveillance society and surveillance theory. And then we also want to talk to you a little bit more specifically about Uganda. So the first question I want to ask you is, what informs your understanding of the resurgence in authoritarian, extremist, and right-wing governments across the globe?
Thank you again for having me here. In response to that question, my own thinking is that if you take each particular geography and look at what the context is locally and what is going on in there, then you can start to map out connections as to what is causing this. For instance, in Europe, that migration pattern of bodies coming in from the coast of Africa is causing a lot of panic. Then when you look here, you could pick a starting point. But in my case, I'll start with the rise of Obama into office and that concomitant rise of the Tea Party, and that set the ground, at least in immediate history, for what is happening all the way building into Trump. And you can make connections between take our country back and make America great again. So when you start to weave these together, you can see that the sentiments kind of laid in, you know, with the rise of Obama, and that stayed right there. And then that led to the emergence finally of Trump. And what follows after that, I think, is an appeasement to that sentiment that wants a very hard-driven policy towards an approach to the world.
There's a compelling economic argument for anxieties that are triggered by globalization. I think you've alluded to that a little bit. Globalization impacting workers all over the world. And that explains, to a degree, some justified anger reflected in the uptake in the politics of divisiveness. What is your comment on that particular perspective?
The opening of national mobilities, borders opening up across our countries and nations has caused a little bit of anxiety, as we can all attest to. On the one hand, we have capital moving from the West to the Global South. And on the other hand, we have bodies moving from the Global South towards the West. And both centered in economic argument, people look seeking survival across into the West, and capital seeking to multiply itself and regenerate by migrating southwards. And when you look at this interplay between the movement on the one hand of bodies for economic reasons, seeking greener pastures, as it's called, and then capital seeking more lucrative ways of multiplying itself to the Global South. So that tension kind of has led to this build-up in which you see that economics is at the center. It's on the table, but we are looking at it from different areas. On the one hand, it's about survival. On the other hand, it's about regeneration and multiplication of profit.
This is Nolan Higdon. I noticed that some of your work is in surveillance and these new technologies. And you're talking about globalization, and we mean that we're talking about this free trade and people working, buying, living across borders that almost don't matter in some respect, but others they do. What do you see as the connection between what I would call like a rise in surveillance and globalization? Is there a connection, or do the two, does one cause the other?
For my research, I would argue that if you look into history, you realize that the connection has always been there, because what we're looking at as globalization today had already been tackled through the process of global exploration under the historical Royal Geographical Society and so forth, and all those expeditions that went around the world under the term exploration. But in a sense, they were mapping resources across different geographies around the world. And so in a sense, personally, for my research, I would argue that that was the template for which globalization 2.0 is now really building upon. And so that process of, if you really look at a critical approach to cartography and mapping and so forth, those were ways of knowing which resources are where, both human and natural resources. And that is the template on which the current wave of globalization is operating, knowing where resources are and how to monitor those resources. That's where surveillance comes in, knowing which is which and what is where and how to extract that.
Is it possible for you to define this area? I'm fascinated by this area that you're dealing with, of what's being called surveillance theory.
Surveillance theory has become very prominent. I would map it on two historical points. After 9/11 and after Edward Snowden. So after 9/11, the security state kicks in, and it is important to protect the good citizens of this country from the bad guys who are likely to come in and cause harm. And so all these measures, starting from the Patriot Act, have to be amped up. So we need to monitor which bodies are deviant and how to extract them from society. And so that speculation went on for quite some time. And the domestic debate was about, okay, how much privacy are we giving up? And all this conversation about these new technologies, social media platforms all cropped up, and how they are leading into big brothering of society. But then all that speculation was killed after Edward Snowden. So when he came up with those revelations, so he'd say, okay, it's no longer speculation. All of this information is being scooped up, and we are trying to gather everything and everything we possibly can about everybody and all modes of communication. And so now it opens up the field to where now we're going to ask ourselves, what's the way forward? Prior to that, the speculation was that, okay, everything is being tapped into, but now that we know that we are being observed, being followed, so where does the frenzy go from here? Now, as a student of history, I am trying not to get into that particular debate and then look back again into history and look at how the architecture or the templates for which modern surveillance is taking place had already existed in the laboratory of colonialism and imperialism. The way they managed the colonies and methods of administration had already set forth the template on which modern technologies of surveillance are operating.
Interesting.
Currently looking at how human behavior changes in the classroom based on surveillance, and looking at the contemporary sense, and I wonder, you said you look at these things as a student of history. So historically, Can you tell us, give me a little brief history on sort of the dramatic changes people have had to surveillance, as when they know they're being surveilled, how they may have changed their behaviors to kind of either adapt or resist surveillance?
I wouldn't say that I have explored that area, that particular question in depth, but my take on that in very, very sketchy research I'm looking at is that surveillance has been commodified in a way that it has muted the effect of people being under observation, because they have by commodification of surveillance, I mean that we have accepted that, well, hey, if you have any piece of digital equipment, it is up for grabs, you know, that somebody can listen in, can tap into it. But because we like these gadgets or devices and they help us make our life a little easier, we are willing to trade in that. And so the effect that would have happened in society in terms of an uproar as a result of all these revelations of surveillance hasn't taken effect because of what I argue is the commodification of surveillance, because it has been embedded into these consumer technologies that we cannot live without. And so it becomes hard for us to wage a pushback against them, whereas while we are benefiting from them. And so being under a surveillance gaze has, to me, I think, not really had the impact it has in terms of anticipated uproar.
Kalim, I had an interesting question where I was thinking, because you have experience being African, being from Africa, or having spent time there and being in America, how you view the ideology that we have around Africa and around them being behind, in a sense, especially as far as technology and industrialization, because we have here iPhones where we have materials being used like coltan that are being mined and being stolen from Africa, and kind of having painted a picture of the constant poverty and devastation that Africa faces, which is not all that Africa faces. That's the one aspect of it, versus new stories coming out. One of the leading new car manufacturers coming out of Africa and kind of competing with our cars here today. How do you view how we feel about it, and what's your experience experiencing both worlds?
Thank you for the question. The way I look at it in context of my research in surveillance, when people ask the question that how come Africa is still the way it is, or how come it is not developing, and I think that is where further research into how surveillance works, especially from a critical post-colonial approach, would help us answer such a question. Every area that had resources in Africa was mapped by early explorers. They knew where natural resources are, where human resources are, everything. They knew where to go get what. And if you remember that the context of the scramble and partition for Africa happened at a point when Europe was industrializing and now figuring out where they're going to get resources, not just for the immediate short term, but for the long term. They need resources and markets to build up their economies. And so the way surveillance ties into this particular question is, so you have to bring in other institutions, organizations to keep the peoples, like in Africa, at bay. So for that forever, they're going to remain either a market for exporting of goods, or an area from which raw materials can be extracted. And how does that surveillance now come into play? When you look at institutions like, say, the IMF and other, even philanthropic organizations, the role they play on the continent is to monitor what is going on and feed it to, I prefer to use the term empire, back home. That is how Africa is monitored, and that is why it never is able to make progress, because every step it tries to make, somebody is watching over and making sure that things remain the way they are. And I don't know if this can tie into that, but I have a very poignant example in a paper I just finished writing, which was looking at the recent rise in state-led homophobia in Uganda particularly. But when you look at it and you go back into history, you look at the fact that the missionaries helped really sow these seeds when they brought in Christianity, and they set the tone that this is how human behavior should be. And then they brought in their laws from my country, because we're a British colony, and also they imported the British penal system and partly incorporated it into our current legal structure. And so in such ways, when you look at how
Africa remains behind or how it is monitored. It is through these historical projects of statecraft, managing empire and administration that set the foundation to make sure that several years later they could come back and keep the situation at bay.
When we're talking about the surveillance infrastructure, I noticed that you're talking about mapping and missionaries as a way of keeping track of resources. But we often in the present day think of surveillance having to do with these digital technologies. So do you encounter a lot of pushback for people who think that maybe keeping a map of resources is not technically surveillance? How would you respond to that claim?
From an Afrocentric point of view, coming from a continent that has been ravaged the way it has, I would stand up against anybody who would make that argument that that was simply exploration. And I think that is where restudying history becomes very important, because the representation of what happened during those imperial voyages was one way of telling a story, but it was a particular narrative based on who was writing that history. And if you go by the African proverb that until lions have their historians, the tales of the hunt will always glorify the hunter, then that will continue to be the case. But when we start to tell our own history, then we can reinterpret what that meant and contextualize it into modern debates about surveillance and authoritarianism and so forth. Because that is how we would view it. That for instance, in my country, when they were building the railway lines, moved from the ports to where resources were. The infrastructure did not really extend so much into where there was nothing to be gained. Except from Mombasa to the Kilembe mines, somewhere in the western part of Uganda, you could see that that railway line was meant to profit, you know, whoever was going to extract that copper from that belt and then take it out. And so did the slave trade routes. They came to where they can get people, move human cargo from this point to that point to the sea and off to the west. So I would really push back strongly about that interpretation of surveillance.
So as a student of history, and I also study critical media studies as well, I find this really fascinating. And so when you talk about this historic trajectory, I noticed for the first part of what we talked about so far, you talked about resources and mapping regions, and you talked about people in groups. But when do we get to the point in history where we're surveilling individuals? We start talking about individual surveillance. Can you talk a little bit about how that exchange happens?
I think surveillance has always and will always kind of be about individuals. It's always about bodies, which bodies are accepted and which are not. And those boundaries are always created maybe through legislation and different kind of means, different cultural ways of drawing boundaries. But what you're trying to do is to monitor the movement of bodies from one boundary to another, to protect it from here or there. And so the gaze is about bodies. It really is about bodies and which bodies are acceptable and not acceptable. Just, I think, was it this week? Trump tweeted about the transgender people not being accepting the army and stuff. You could see that there is always something located in the physicality of the body, that it's going to be a black body, a transgender body, or this kind of body, but the focus of the gaze is always on a particular body and the type of deviance that is inscribed on that particular body.
Interestingly enough, my discipline of anthropology, which I have my master's and my doctorate, is profoundly involved. Anthropology was profoundly involved in this project of surveillance, as I'm hearing it from you. I mean, anthropology is part of the colonial project. Only really since the 1980s and subaltern scholars in India has the lion begun to tell his or her story about this particular trade and surveillance. What I'm interested in, too, are things where the individual body that has been surveilled gains access to technology that allows them to turn the surveillance on the one who has always surveilled them, or allows them access to equal the scales. So recently, there was an assassination in Kenya. I don't know if you followed that, around revising election procedures by introducing biometric technologies into voting. I know that it was a close election, okay? And so part of this was about tilting the scales mm-hmm. on that. But it seems as though when the people get their hands on something that's technological in Africa and in the rest of the world, that there's some attempt to destabilize that.
I suddenly heard about that gentleman who just passed away in Kenya, who was responsible gatekeeping, you know, the electoral process in terms of the computer work, really sad. I don't know if I can speculate as to how what's going on in Kenya. Really, I can't. But the way this what I can say about the technologies, I mean, I try to look at them as tools. Now, the question would be that, is it possible for us to get the tools, the bodies that are subject to the gaze, to get the tools and mm-hmm. flip the gaze onto the person who's gazing at them and or maybe gaze back at them? As a practical question, maybe that is possible to happen, but when I push this further, I think it should be less about the tools and we really have to go back and investigate what it is in the human condition that would cause us to appropriate these tools to subjugate other people. Because if it becomes about that, in the immediate short run, it can leverage things, just like North Korea would say. We saw what happened in Libya, for instance, so we're maintaining our nukes. You got them, we got them, so we had a stalemate. But that does not resolve the tension between the two parties. And I think it really would come down to, I think, what it means to be a human being and respect other human beings the way you'd want to be respected. And the conversation for me has to shift from the technologies to that level whereby the conversation has got to be had as human beings.
All right, you're listening to the Project Censored Show, and I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host Desiree McSwain and Nicholas Bayham III, and we are talking to Kalima Kazito, and we will be back after this short musical break. Welcome. Back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host Desiree McSwain and Dr. Nicholas Bayham III. We are talking to Kalima Kazito. Kalima is a doctoral student at the University of Memphis and his research focuses on critical media and cultural studies with a primary focus on exploring the role of emerging technologies as a cultural force.
Kalima, I wanted to echo what you said about emphasizing the pillaging in Africa and everything that's gone on throughout and almost the race between a lot of established colonies or empires to kind of run back to Africa and revisit maybe what they have forgotten or maybe what they forgot they had mapped, like you said, about resources. So where you have China now, who I think is just now opening their first military base in Africa. Now there's a big debate about whether they should teach Chinese in schools as another language, and almost the fight between maybe India and China about who's really the first to maybe merge or explode in Africa today versus Africa 30 years ago.
China is, by all means, a colonizing force. No doubt about that. And scholars will get into the difference between European colonialism and Chinese colonialism. But on the ground, from what I have gathered, African governments are more willing to work with China more than they are willing to work with the West. Now, granted, there has been enough history for them to make that decision and say, okay, we're going to work with China as our new partner. But there are a few distinctions here. China has come in strictly on a business front. We're doing business with you, so you might know they're exploiting you, extracting you, but give you this in return, and we'll extract this much in return. And they do not get engaged into any kind of politics or cultural stuff. It's just they are the businessmen, you know, they're there to exploit, so that's what you get. And then on the other hand, in the West, as you've all studied this, the colonial script, in Africa they say the flag followed the cross, so you had to bring in pacifying force, Christianity, then you get into cultural mores of people, what is acceptable, you cannot do this, and with that then you get the political part of it, that's where empire comes in, and It's imperial administration, the education and the schools. So those are two different styles. Now, as an African, I would say that both of them are colonizing forces. And how can Africa respond and read? And if it were up to me, I would make this a compulsory read, Chinwezu's book, The West and the Rest of Us, to really rethink about this entire colonial project in its historical context and see if lessons can be really drawn by Africans on how to proceed. But right now, I don't know if I can suggest anything that would not put them from one colonial power into the hands of another colonial power.
It kind of seems like you were at the beginning of that talking about engaging in a strategy, which is aligning with China, definitely a colonizing force, but kind of like the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Maybe creating that power vacuum with China, the U.S., Russia, India, right? You have these. There's kind of a power vacuum. We're seeing a splitting of power.
This is Nick Bahim. It seems to me that along the lines of this discussion, that there are two important historical examples. There's a 1955 Conference of Bandung with recently liberated African and Asian nations, something that was very moving to developing Malcolm X. And then there's also the example of Japanese colonialism leading up to World War II. Where Japan presented themselves as a kindler, gentler face of colonialism for Asia, a sort of a contrast to European colonialism. And it seems to me that what you're helping us to understand is that between those two historical examples, China's incursion into Africa veers more towards that Japanese example than the example of Bandung. It seems to me that it's more of the Japanese example of we're going to be a kindler, gentler, more capitalist-centered, purely capitalist-centered face of colonialism than what the Europeans did to you for centuries. Is that inaccurate? First of all, are those sort of historical metaphors accurate in terms of defining the sort of different polar axes?
Yeah, it seems accurate. And like I was saying in the beginning, that they still remain different stripes of colonialism. And to me, I think it elevates the dilemma for the future about Africa. Because if you're just switching from one colonial force to another, then your future is still not guaranteed, if I might put it that way. And so the strong presidents of the 60s, the Nkrumahs, Samora Machel, and all those people, now that they're all gone, and then we have a new wave of just corrupt, pilfering presidents. So the stakes are very high about what happens down the line in Africa. And as long as Africa is still in the condition in which it is, the condition of black people, I think, all over the world still remains in question, because the motherland has to really be liberated for black people elsewhere in the diaspora to really regain their sense of true worth. And as long as we still have these competing colonial forces with their gaze set on Africa, with no formidable response from within the continent, then the problem still remains. It's still there.
So, Kalimba, where can people get a hold of you or access your work?
Surveillance and Society, the leading journal that deals with surveillance theory, it's an open access journal, it's online, and some of my work is on their website, Surveillance and Society. And I can also be reached via email, the University of Memphis Communication Department. Once they go to that website, my work is available under my profile over there.
You don't have a Twitter account?
Yeah, exactly. We're into Twitter accounts.
You know, that is very, very interesting. And I don't know, because as a student of communication, I do not own any social media platform. And
you don't want to be surveilled.
It's my act of resistance.
Yeah. You practice
I
what
try
you preach.
Not to.
All yeah. right.
Yes.
See, guys, it's not just me.
Maybe you're right.
Oh,
we should join Desiree.
I have an Instagram and a Facebook that I use to surveil Facebook, but that's it.
Look what we did. We opened the doorway for Desiree to get out. All right. Listen, Kalimba, great guest. He is Kalimba Kizito. That's K-A-L-E-M-B-A. Last name K-I-Z-I-T-O. It was a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we'll be back after this short musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host Desiree McSwain and Nicholas Baham III. At the Media Freedom Foundation, we produce content that illuminates the work of fact-based journalists around the world and offers alternative narratives to the corporate press. Amy Casey is here to tell us more.
Greetings, listeners. This is Amy Casey of the Media Freedom Foundation with some highlights of student-generated content featuring authoritarian themes. From Diablo Valley College, Project Censored director Mickey Huff and his student Christopher Krause have nominated a validated independent news story, that is, a story ignored by the corporate press but covered by the independent press, titled Billionaire Trump Advisor to Make Mass Profits from Mass Deportation While Violating Civil Liberties. The story reports of the impending September launch of a $20 billion data mining firm by President Trump's defense advisor Peter Thiel and his company, Palantir Technologies. The technology created by the firm will allow the collection and consolidation of information on up to 11 million people living undocumented in the U.S. to assist the impending mass deportations, in addition to the capability of targeting U.S. citizens in the future. That can be found at projectcensored.org. In another validated independent news story, this time from Citrus College, Project Censored Associate Director Andy Lee Roth and his student Michael Anthony Valdez Jr. have published Israel to Deport Pro-Palestinian Activists and Outlaw Foreign Supporters. The article identified the proposed Israeli legislation aimed to effectively outlaw BDS activists and foreign supporters of the pro-Palestinian human rights movement. This VIN can be found at projectcensored.org. At this time, I would like to remind our listeners to check out projectcensored.org/podcast. There you can access free content and show your support for the Project Censored show. For any feedback, questions, comments, concerns, please send us an email to projectcensoredradio@gmail.com. Nick and Nolan have joined the Twitter sphere. You can reach them at Nolan_Higdon or Dr. Dreadlocks. That's DOCTORDREDLOCKS. I'm Amy Casey, and that is the news that did not make the news.
Thank you very much, Amy, and thank you very much to our guests. You've been listening to the Project Censored show. I'm Nolan Higdon with Desiree McSwain and Nicholas Baham III. Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips are our executive producers and hosts. Our intern and special announcer is Amy Casey. Mitch Scorza is our director and engineer. Project Censored show airs on nearly 40 stations around the U.S. Please follow us and like us on Facebook. Send us an email at projectcensoredradio@gmail.com. And visit our website online at projectcensored.org, where you can find the archives of all our radio shows for the past 6 years, as well as 40 years of news that didn't make the news. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, 'cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.